Thank you very much for the very generous introduction, Sven. And I'd like to start by saying it's a pleasure to be here today. And I'd like to thank the organizers, Ulrich, Serhat, and Stefan, and Sven in particular, for the invitation to be here today. And I have to say that yesterday I fell in love with the town too, so, that's a way of saying I'd be happy to be back. I also need to start with a recognition of blame, taking account of Sven's initial comments, critical comments towards international relations by saying that, as you have heard, that my home is in international relations. So I come from that discipline. But what I try to do today is actually cross disciplinary boundaries. I'm looking forward, it's very exciting to have here so many people who are working in sociology, because I try to cross some of these boundaries, and I'm really keen to hear your thoughts and whether you think it makes sense. The paper I'll be talking about today is a project that started about a year ago, and it started around developments that have been taking place around counterterrorism in the UK. Along what I call the problematization of crowded places, again, problematization is a term that has Foucauldian resonances. I use it in the spirit of Foucauldian analysis, but it's basically this collage of crowded places that has been really interesting for me. And the whole series of new developments taking place around emergency planning, but taking place around ideas about crowds and the role of crowds in security dispositives. And I think crowded places is a way, and that's what I try to argue, is a way to actually insert crowds very strongly at the heart of emergency planning and at the heart of the security dispositive of counterterrorism. So what I was planning to do today is actually take you through a very disparate, if you want, heterogeneous series of developments that have been taking place in the UK. And I'll also be very keen to hear your thoughts in terms of what is happening elsewhere, whether you see any resonance between this proliferation of discourses around crowds that I've been talking about, and if you want security dispositives here and elsewhere. So I want to take you first to a discussion of these heterogeneous sites where I think something is happening, and then engage into a discussion about the politics of these changes. So again, I associate security dispositive very closely with questions of politics. Now, I have a slight dilemma, because I had about four pictures that I wanted to show to you, but I realized that I have to negotiate between having the light in my eyes and showing you the picture. So I could use them at the beginning and then simply switch it off again if it's not too. The UK Home Office and the UK-based company Secure Futures organised a competition for young architects to incorporate protective security measures into crowded places. The competition, called at the time Public Spaces Secure Places, followed a report and recommendation by Lord Wellesley. constitute security and include counter-terrorist protection in the design of crowded places. The brief for this competition asked young architects to redesign a public square in an unidentified European city which had been completely destroyed, according to the brief, after a horrific terrorist attack involving both pedestrian and vehicular delivered explosive devices. The competition, which received about 100 entries, was won by the architect Peter Hughes with this project called the Duff and Earth Branch. What is interesting for me in this competition is that it highlighted a different problematization of terrorism as an unexpected attack in a crowded place. So the unknowability and unpredictability of terrorist attack is reformulated as a governmental emergency in a crowded place. Crowded places are a recent invention. If you go back a few years, you don't find this phrase in Ukraine, but you know, in governmental documents. It is a new object of governing which needs to be explained and known. And this is a bit obvious if you start reading the reports, because they all start with the question, what are crowded places? Or there's this need to define, you know, find out what is this new reality. And also different taxonomies by way of definition. So the company Secure Futures, as I mentioned at the beginning, defines crowded places as basically ubiquitous in social life. So crowded places are equivalent to the social. And my favorite quote from Secure Places is, crowded places are everywhere we go. They are the high street and the shopping center, the station platform and the bus queue, the busy cinema and the sold-out venue. They are the public spaces we use. Crowded places are also where we are our most vulnerable to attack and emergency. And you have a whole series of different definitions that permeate all these documents. So for instance, the National Counterterrorism and Security Office in the Ukraine regards crowded places as location or environments to which members of the public have access that, on the basis of intelligence, credible threat or terrorist methodology, may be considered potentially liable to terrorist attack by virtue of their crowd density. The UK government is slightly more restrained in how it defines crowded places, but it still draws up a long list of places which are now renamed as crowded places. And if you might find less surprising the fact that, you know, bus parks, restaurants and hotels come under crowded places, more recently they have added the health sector in its entirety, the education sector, the crowded place, religious sites and places of worship. Now, so this is one site that I want to talk about. At the same time that this competition was taking place, if you have a whole series of questionings about crowded places, the National Counterterrorism and Security Office in the UK was rolling out Project Argus, which is an exercise particularly targeted at businesses, which depicts a scenario of social visual media taking place in real time and asks players to make decisions in the event of a terrorist attack. So it basically lives through the terrorist attack and make decisions. Now, what is interesting again for me about Project Argus is that it responds again to government consultation on protective security and the series of three documents which outline security measures to be taken by the police, local authorities, businesses, emergency planners, architects, and basically all the citizens. And you have some of this here, working together to protect crowded places, the planning system and counter-terrorism, and protecting crowded places, design and technical issues. Two of these have been revised and have new versions of those in 2012, one of the new ones here. In parallel to this, this is slide number two, in parallel to these events and consultations, the UK Civil Contingency Secretariat and Emergency Planning College commissioned another series of reports, again under the bigger heading of emergency planning, entitled Understanding Crowd Behaviours. There are five of those, you can see here's three that are freely accessible online. The reports drafted by the Leeds University and incorporated in the UK Civil Protection Guidance define the need to think about crowds and security in very similar terms to the definition of crowded places. So they say similar things like crowds are part of our everyday lives, therefore there's a huge interest in crowds and we need to provide protective security. And finally, again at the same time, about the same time, another interest in the role of crowds, but this time is linked with policing and the policing of protests and what is called public border policing in the UK. Another report commissioned by Her Majesty's Chief Inspector of Constabulary, called Adapting to Protests, Nurturing the British Model of Policing, having a special section dedicated to crowd dynamics and public border policing. And what is interesting here for me is again the placing of crowds at the heart of the security dispositive, and one can talk about continuities here, but also the fact that the part dedicated to crowds was commissioned and written by a social psychologist called Clifford Scott, a social psychologist at the University of Liverpool. This interest in crowded places and crowd behaviours in emergency situation seems to be increasingly entwined through the work of its four sides with mechanisms of crowd and protest control. But particularly what I want to show today in this paper is how this dispositive and the role of crowds is underpinned by a particular form of social psychological knowledge that circulates between these different sides. And this knowledge circulates through the use of academic expertise. So problematizing terrorism through crowded places allows for the social psychological knowledge of crowd to enter the realm of counterterrorism. And what I want to explore is actually the politics of these intersections. What happens when emergency planning becomes a matter of managing the crowded places? What happens when crowds, if you are asked, political subjects are governed increasingly in relation to unexpected events such as the next terrorist attack? So knowledge about crowds and their potentially disruptive behaviours is mobilised in order to respond to the problematisation of crowded places as targets of the next terrorist attack. And one can see here on the one hand about the specialization of crowds in this problematization of crowded places and what the role of space entails to reduce the uncertainty and contingency of terrorists, but also of crowds. But I want to focus today on two other aspects, on two other effects in terms of this placing of crowds at the heart of the security dispositive. And I'll try to unpack these two facts. On the one hand, I want to argue that what happens through the mediation of social psychological knowledge and through the placing of crowds at the heart of the security dispositive is that workplaces are increasingly rendered as crowded places. And on the other fact that I want to talk about is the fact that crowds are de-democratized. And if you might, I use here the term referring to Wendy Brown, we could also say depoliticized. Now, what I want to do after studying this out, what I want to do for the rest of the talk is actually start by thinking a little bit about the absence of interest in crowds. In the recent, I think, social science literature, but also, if you want, less radical philosophy. Although political transformation is entwined with ideas about collective subjectivity, crowds, I would say, have been by and large absent from the canopy of reconceptualizations of collective subjects, particularly under conditions of globalization, transnationalization, and neoliberalism. So in the moment, one would say that increasingly dispersed forms of insecurity and violence have become constitutive of daily life, It is therefore hardly surprising that we should rethink collective subjects. However, as new collective subjects need to respond to these transformations, we see increasingly, at least from last day in my discipline, I'm looking at other disciplines, we see an increased focus on the language of community, publics, and multitude, at the expense of the language of crowds. Community seems to me is one of the concepts most invoked in political science, sociology, and philosophy, however some doubt that not necessarily so well theorized. And you have today, particularly in relation to work of radical democracy, an invocation of communities to come, for example. You have a whole work of rethinking world communities. While crowds, for instance, as William Mazzarella put it in an article in Public Culture, remind us of a pre-liberal imaginary. So there's a whole periodization of collective political subject as well, in which crowds are ultimately anachronistic, that they belong to the past. Each of these new conceptualizations, I like to argue, so communities, publics, and multitudes, respond to a particular problem of the present. So world communities, for instance, respond to the dispersion and fragmentation of practices of governance, addressing institutional discourse through imagined proximity. And in my discipline, one can see that ideas about communities or world communities reject a nationalized version of communities, rather reject a nationalized version of community, or they try to see, what post-national or the formation of post-national communities could be. Publics, again, transcend the territorial and temporal limits of the nation state through what I'll say is a mediatized, virtualized, and effective world spectatorship. Not surprisingly, publics have also been defined, particularly in relation to discourses and texts, and therefore there's an idea that publics do not require physical presence that crowds appear to do. And finally, and perhaps most famously, the concept of multitudes. Multitudes imagine to see the changes in the processes of production, from full disorganization of production to neoliberal flexibilization and in which the labor. So again, the idea of the multitude as an autonomous political subject replacing the crowd. And I find Michael Hart's, for example, comment on the difference between multitudes and crowds particularly useful. To try to make sense of this move of erasing the crowd from, theoretical engagement. So for Hart, crowds, mobs, and masses have to be opposed to multitudes, because multitude is a singularity, and crowds efface difference. And I want to read out a quote from him, because I think it's really helpful for this attitude of erasure of the political subjectivity of crowds. So Michael Hart says, one might say that all these concepts designate social multiplicity, but really the apparent difference between the crowd and the masses is in fact the difference. Too often, the apparent multiplicity turns out to be merely an indifferent unity. The concept of the multitude, in contrast, is meant to name a set of singularities, that is, differences that remain different. On the other hand, the distinction of the multitude has to do with the passivity of the crowd, masses, and mob, which is closely related to their indifference. The mob, of course, along with the crowd and the masses, can do things, sometimes horrible things, but it is nonetheless fundamentally passive in the sense that it needs to rely and cannot act of its own accord, autonomously. Now, to me, Hart's comments resonate quite strongly, they replicate the main assumptions of Le Bon's 19th century psychology of the crowds, and I'll get to that a bit later on. This idea of the periodization of crowds and crowds being an anachronistic subject has been implications of industrial capitalism. And you have a lot of debate about, again, the debate I started with, about what happens when the conditions of industrial capitalism are changing. But it seems to me surprising, if not a little bit strange, to pronounce the death of the crowd at a time when crowds seem to be increasingly present on the political arena. They are present in the economic sphere, for those of you who might have heard of crowd intelligence, crowd sources, so they become a source of production of value. They are present in political protests, and I'm thinking here not just the so-called Arab Spring, but the protests around Europe and elsewhere. And they are particularly present, I want to argue, in the security dispositives of governance. So how come, and this is if you want my gripe for this paper, with some of the literature, that actually faces the role of the crowds. So if they are still present, it seems to me that we need to take crowds and the knowledge about crowds in the security dispositive seriously and think about what it means. And I will do this now, in the time I have left, in two steps. I'll try to do this relatively quickly. In the first step, I will examine to the literature on understanding crowd behaviors. And in the second step, to counterterrorism exercises. And draw some conclusions. The logical understanding of crowd behaviors is particularly interesting as it reviews the literature on crowds, starting with Gustave Le Bon in the 19th century, briefly noting the contributions of Marxist historians like E.P. Thompson, and moving quickly to review in depth the psychological theories of crowd behavior. What these documents do is actually propose new theories of crowd behavior. John called social psychological theories of crowd behavior, particularly the so-called social identity model, or what is often referred to as the elaborate social identity model. Developed by the psychologist Stephen Reicher at the University of St. Andrews, John Drury at Sussex University, and Clifford Stock at Liverpool University. At about the same time, this literature is also informing the other series of documents that I have shown you. Clifford Stock, one of the representatives of the social identity model of crowd management, being involved in this report about crowd policing and policing of protests. So this literature rejects 19th century crowd psychology and aims to offer a more political reading of the crowd, if you want, rejecting questions of pathologization, rejecting particularly the repressive passions of the police. Now, for Clifford's thought, the elaborated social identity model of crowd behavior is seen, in his words, as the leading scientific theory of crowd psychology. And what this model does is that it recognizes the contextually determined nature of crowd action and defines the social psychological processes determining the positive and negative impacts of police tactics, the effects that it can have upon crowd dynamics. So this new psychosocial knowledge of crowd behavior embraces constructivist approaches to social identity and sees itself as reacting strongly to the predominant pathologization of the crowd inherited from his 19th century psychological, criminological, and social theory. So it rejects the main ideas of Le Bon around suggestibility, hypnosis, imagination, emotional contagion, and that's pathologization. So Stephen Reicher reads Le Bon's argument in very political terms. So he's aware of the fact that 19th century crowd psychology was a political project, and he said it needs to replace this political project. Rejected. So according to Reicher, Le Bon divorces crowds from social context and deletes intergroup relations, for instance, the interaction between crowds and police. Rather, he argues, crowds are constituted from a motley of different people, and when confronted with a particular emergency situation, their identities are transformed and they experience the crowd as unity rather than collection of groups. Now, for those of you familiar with security literature and international relations, that might sound very familiar. Therefore, the argument against reform is that cards often remain organized and cooperative in emergency situations. This model is based on a particular understanding of identity. So rather than identity being dissipated in the third of the 19th century cult psychologists, identity is reconfigured as a social identity. Crowds themselves are not this exceptional phenomenon that happens, but they are ultimately not any different from any other social group. Yeah? So crowds become simply a social group. And what is important in this theory for understanding crowds and crowd behavior and understanding emergency planning is basically thinking about the dynamics between groups in crowds. Yeah? And also dynamics between what they call in groups and out groups. And this leads to a whole series of consequences in terms of governance. So what this literature does is that it rejects impressive police tactics. And it argues that once sees crowds in this identitarian class, what matters in terms of governance are questions of communications, questions of identification, and questions of leadership. And this is something that Clifford Scott's comments that I want to read out to you about the student demonstrations in London on the 9th of December 2011 are actually revealing for what this type of knowledge does. So Scott says in his criticism of police action, the police needed to communicate with the crowd about what was required, necessary, and legitimate. But that didn't happen. There was simply no communication with the crowd. Inevitably, the police were forced to move towards containment. But even if that were necessary, they should have had elements of the police ready to communicate during containment itself. The vast bulk of the crowd were students who simply wanted to protest and go home. So it seems to me that you already have here an indication of the depoliticization of crowds. The students only wanted to protest and go home. Any problem of legitimacy, illegitimacy can be dealt with through communication and leadership. The police actions only become illegitimate if they target, whole crowds. So therefore, this literature suggests that you need to do risk assessment and pay close attention to the different groups that make up the crowd. So police action will never be legitimate a priority. So this question of legitimacy and illegitimacy actually played out in this moment of communication. However, this does not mean, it seems to me, that ideas about crowd panic, pathology, and conflict disappear. They are just reduced to particularly risky subgroups and particularly surprising circumstances. Indeed, Peter has started to talk a lot about no surprising policing. Yeah, so the theory kind of applies the social identity model, kind of asks for more differentiated techniques of governance. This does not mean that repression is out of the story. It is just more limited. Now, a second moment that I want to talk about in terms of unraveling, or in terms of bringing out the politics of crowds as subjects in the security dispositive is that of the so-called Argus exercises in the UK. Psychosocial knowledge about crowd behaviors also underpins, I like to argue, these emergency planning exercises. So Argus exercises are run by so-called counter-terrorism and security advisors in the UK. They're basically run by local police forces, together with local authorities, emergency services, fire and health, and they address themselves to businesses. So what happens, you sit in a room like this, where you sit around the tables and watch a video that plays after terrorism attack. And the terrorist attack is play up in three parts. You have a tech part one, a tech part two, and a tech part three. And after each part of the attack, you stop and you come back inside and watch your actions should be. Now, there's another exercises which are dedicated to businesses more generally, not as crowded places. So, Argus is targeted at crowded places. The exercise is on response, where you would respond, but also crowd behavior. So, how are people likely to behave, and what measures should be taken in response to these behaviors? So, to go back to the company I started with, Secure Food Chart, they encapsulate the problem that Argus exercises purport to address when they say that crowds and public places are very difficult to protect. And if tragedy or danger strikes, it can often be mass casualties, major damage, as well as widespread chemical fear. There is a loss of control, communication, and containment. Now, in the attack part two, the problem of crowd behavior becomes darker. A second explosion, attack part two means basically a secondary explosion. So you have first explosion, attack part one, second explosion, attack part two. What participants are told is that the staff are panicking and want to leave. So what happens at that moment in the exercise is that the participants focus on the constitution of authority and leadership through the mediation of objects. Leadership is also very important. We focus that much on it in the social psychology literature. Here, it's, you know, part of the exercise is focused on the constitution of leadership through this mediation of objects. So you need to have the right object at hand that would allow for you to become a leader of the crowd. And this can be, you know, the grab bag is really important, and it usually contains things like the first jacket, like a megaphone. So you have a whole series of paraphernalia that allow, either human resources managers or safety managers to become leaders and communicate with the crowd. So again, leader figures and communication are the heart of response of governance. So what is needed in emergency times, according to exercise wisdom, is a strong leader who can escalate panic and fear among the crowd. And there is no difference if you look at these exercises are played out in the public places, so therefore there is no difference between a concert stadium or a demonstration. The same kind of modes of governance are supposed to be played out. Now, what I want to add is that if one takes, goes and takes part in some of these exercises, it becomes obvious that it is not simply the crowded place as a public place that's a state here, that's a region, but it's actually the workplace as a public place. All these exercises take place in workplaces, whether it's a shopping center, whether it's a cinema, whether it's a university. And the leaders that the exercises try to create, are neither self-identified, so you cannot just go and grab the grab bag, because it would be locked safely somewhere, nor are they elected. There are human resources or safety managers, as I was saying earlier, in particular businesses who have the keys. And the crowds are not the throngs of shoppers, the congregation of passengers at airport terminals, or the streams of protesters in a public square. They are the workers themselves. It is the workers who have to go through these emergency exercises all the time. And I will use another quote, if you can bear with me for another quote. This time is a quote from The Guardian from 2009. The Guardian was referring to, again, quoting itself, Jackie Smith, at the time Home Secretary in the UK, saying that Smith said that 30,000 workers, and workers rather than any other term is interesting here, had been trained to help respond to a terror attack as part of the strategy, and said that the program would be extended to further 30,000 people. Now, this emphasis on workers seems to me to be quite interesting. because it is the workplace and the worker which are reconfigured as public places and crowds. In all those exercises within our actuality, it is the same psychosocial knowledge that underpins the measures that need to be taken. And again, talking about the suggestibility of the crowds, the role of leadership, the crowd's propensity to act as one, the problem of the individual being engulfed by the mass. However, these exercises also they don't replicate 19th century pathologization of the crowd, but are actually developed by, if you want, this more sophisticated social psychological knowledge of crowds. There is no generalized mass, there is no will of the crowd. Crowds are differentiated according to their risk identity, their disorderly nature, and relative amenability to control. Thus, if the police communicate particular rules of behavior and particular expectations, crowds which do not conform, are framed as pathological. So what does it mean? I want to turn on to the final point, and I'll come to this will be that's the final 5 minutes. To the final point of this argument, in which I argue that what happens is that crowds become de-democratized, and they become democratized through this social psychological knowledge. So as I told you earlier in this presentation, the social psychology of crowds, the new theories about crowds, reject the so-called de-individuation approaches, 19th century crowd psychology, which are the individual's experience also of identity in the crowd. Therefore, collective identity, communication, and leadership are the key identifiers for emergency preparedness and planning, informed by this theoretical approaches. These assumptions are problematic in as much as I like to suggest they de-democratize crowds. First, this new psychosocial knowledge can be applied indiscriminately across the social. There's no difference between types of crowds. Police control that kind of focus, for example, on football crowds and so on. It kind of circulates and can be applied to all types of gathering, including the workplace. After all, as I started in this paper, called Insecure Futures, crowded places are everywhere we go. So this knowledge is circulating and informing all these forms of governance. Now, by situating crowds in the continuity of all social interaction, this new psychosocial approaches seems to me face the similarity of modes of sociality which emerge through the constitution of crowds. But I want to suggest there is a different way in which one can think about crowds as political subjects, in which one can think about the individuation, not as a loss of identity, or not by reformulating social identity, by thinking of crowds as the constitution of a particular form of sociality. And I do this by reading an absence in the history of crowd theory that the psychosocial approaches are saying. And this absence, and for many of you this might sound all very familiar, is actually Elias Canetti's crowd and power, Elias Canetti's crowd theory. So all these literature reviews with a whole history of crowd theory, psychological, social theory, skips Elias Canetti. Now very interestingly, one of the representatives of the psychosocial approaches actually engaged into a debate with the sociologist Christian Borg, who started to draw on Canetti to think of the politics of crowds by rejecting, offering a fierce criticism and rejecting any reference to Canetti. So, for instance, Christian Borg draws on Canetti to argue that the bodily compression of crowds liberates individuals and creates a democratic transformation. So for him, it's this kind of equal physicality, materiality, of density of craft that can actually lead to this political transformation. And this is exactly what the social psychological approaches would reject. The fierce argument against Bourg, and by extension against Canetti, is that they actually take us back all the way to Le Bon. They take us back to this crowd mind theory, and they deny the right of the crowd as a rational actor. Now, I think that this critique absolutely misses the point, but it says something about what social psychological approaches do. There might be a problem, and as we'll be talking about affect in the course of these 2 days, there might be an issue with Bourg's reading, which I think emphasizes touch, density, body-to-body physical assemblage. They might take him a bit across to Le Bon. But I think if one goes back to Canetti and the erasure of Canetti from this whole history of crowd theory, one can find a different understanding of the crowd. Crowds, which I would argue, are political subjects by excellence, which have rational goals, which have a tendency to grow, and challenge boundaries set by any institutions. So what I find interesting in Canetti, for instance, is the fact that the crowd stands for absolute equality. And in a sense, the crowd would be antithetic to, if you want, publics or audiences. Crowds challenge the boundaries that communities depend on at the same time. So Canetti says that in the crowd, the individual feels that he is confronting the limits of his own person. With the lifting of these burdens of distance, he feels free. His freedom is the crossing of boundaries. Canetti allows us to think, if you want, the distinction between the workplace and the crowd. For Canetti, the workplace can never be a crowded place. The workplace becomes a crowded place, a place inhabited by political subjects only in the event of a strike. The workplace has a lot of hierarchical and inegalitarian place, and he argued that only when workers stop work, that they all do the same thing. Yeah. It is as though their hands had dropped at exactly the same moment, and now they had to exert all their strength not to leave them again. So this is a political moment of transformation of the workplace through this equality and freedom that are linked with the political subjectivity of crowds. And it seems to me that what happens with the social psychology of crowds is that this aspect of politicization, this democratic aspect of equality and freedom, is effaced as crowds are inserted into forms of social governance that emphasize social identity, differentiation and hierarchy, particularly through the use of communication and the role of leadership. So I'd like to suggest that even insecurity is positive, that even when faced with emergencies and disasters, it is perhaps the equality and the freedom of the crowd that would be the most interesting element to explore, in terms of both challenging the security dispositive, but also not denying the effects that emergencies and disasters have upon all of us. So as a final comment, it is therefore, I would say, not surprisingly, that Canetti is missing from all this literature on social psychology that is inserted and allows for the security dispositive to expand and to travel between all these different sites that I try to bring to you today visually and in my paper. And it is perhaps going back to Canetti, but that's also something that we can explore, that we can think of crowds as political subjects. But also think of, again, avoiding such as crowds means false thinking security responsibilities, false thinking forms of knowledge, but also the role of subject, not as just as subject of governance, subject of security, but also as democratic political subjects. Thank you very much.